people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, or no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish it didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Bukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, September 21st, 2011. As the UN General Assembly meets in New York, Palestinians march in support of request for full UN membership, and Israeli settlers rally against it in the West Bank. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Dozens of Palestinian protesters were wounded Wednesday during a rally at Qalandia checkpoint between Ramallah and Jerusalem in support of the Palestinian bid at the United Nations as the General Assembly meets today. The wounded suffered severe headache before they pass out as a result of the gas Israeli soldiers operating at the checkpoint used against them. Troops also used high-frequency sound waves against the protesters. Witnesses reported to Waffen News Agency that Israeli soldiers have used new kind of gas that seems to be toxic gas, which causes victims to keel over as they inhale it. The wounded were evacuated to Ramallah Hospital for treatment. Medical sources at the hospital said one youth had a critical injury as he was shot with a tear gas canister in the eye. Tens of thousands of Palestinians took to the streets on Wednesday in numerous Palestinian cities and villages to support the decision of the Palestinian Authority to submit a request of full UN membership on Friday. The Palestinian political factions and groups organized rallies and demonstrations in the West Bank inside the Palestinian Authority-controlled areas to avoid any confrontation with the Israeli soldiers or settlers. All state employees worked half-time on Wednesday in order to give them a chance to participate in the rallies. The Israeli military has prepared the settlers to encounter alleged Palestinian possible demonstrations. The army equipped the settlers with tear gas, concussion grenades, and rubber-coated steel bullets to use against Palestinians. In the meantime, Israeli extremist settlers continued their provocative marches in the West Bank, close to Palestinian villages and towns. The Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is set to meet with the U.S. President Barack Obama in New York Wednesday afternoon after the latter meets with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Dr. Nabil Sha'at, head of the International Relations for Fatah, said that the Palestinians are not afraid from the American pressure or any punitive action that Washington may take against them as they reject their going to the UN. He added that 9 members of the Security Council support the Palestinian request for recognition of their state. He pointed to Abbas's willingness to meet with Netanyahu tomorrow and to launch direct negotiations between the two sides. On his part, Obama said in his speech to the UN General Assembly meeting in New York Wednesday morning that the Palestinian people deserve a state of their own and the U.S. supports that. However, this should come through negotiations. The White House in Washington confirmed last night that the U.S. opposed the Palestinian request, and if necessary, it will use veto to stop it. That was just some of the news from Palestine today. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, George Rushmal.
Mahmoud Abbas, chairman of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, or PLO, and president of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, is traveling to the opening session of the United Nations in New York this week, where he says he intends to apply for membership as the world's 194th state in the UN Security Council. If he does, the U.S. has promised to use its veto to defeat the proposal. Further, the U.S. Consul General in Jerusalem, Daniel Rubenstein, has stated that the U.S. would cut aid to the Palestinian Authority if the PLO moves ahead with its UN bid for statehood. Abbas, also known as Abu Mazen, has the additional option of making an application in the UN General Assembly to advance the PLO's status from observer entity to observer state, encompassing pre-1967 Palestine, including Gaza, all of the West Bank, and East Jerusalem, territory that many previous UN resolutions recognize as illegally occupied territory that Israel must leave. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of books including Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, A Primer, and Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's UN. She explains that any decision the Palestinians make can result in both positive and negative consequences. Bennis also points out that the situation is complicated by Israel's boots on the ground in occupied Palestine, with more than 500,000 Jewish settlers living in the Israeli-controlled West Bank and East Jerusalem, and a heavy military presence throughout the territories.
The situation on the ground, obviously, is militarily occupied. It is filled with more than 600,000 illegal settlers. These are Jewish Israeli settlers who live in Jews-only settlements, who are violating international law every morning simply by waking up in their own beds. This decision in the UN is not going to change that. It's a political move, and it does two important things and raises two important dangers. The positive things it does is, number one, and probably most important, it challenges the idea that the only game in town is the Washington-backed 21-year-long failure of a so-called peace process. That hasn't worked for 21 years. There's no particular reason to think it's going to work anytime in the future. So this says, once and for all, the venue for Palestinian-Israeli diplomacy is the United Nations, not the State Department. Number two, even if what I believe to be the more likely decision is made by the Palestinians to go not to the Security Council, where the U.S. certainly will veto a membership bid, but rather, I think, regardless of the fact that Abu Mazen says he will go first to the Security Council, I don't think he will. Possible, but I think he will go first to the General Assembly, where the request will be not for membership, but for recognition as a non-member state. The significance of that is not so much within the UN. It means the Palestinians would still not be able to vote, for example, in the General Assembly. They wouldn't be a member. But it means that the UN has recognized them as a state. Member or non-member is not so important. If you're a, quote, state, you can join other treaties. You can sign the treaty, for example, to join the International Criminal Court. That means that in theory, and again, all of this has far more to do with political will of various parties than it does with the official move. But in theory, it means that the Palestinians could join the International Criminal Court, giving the court jurisdiction over its territory. As a signatory to the International Criminal Court, the Palestinians could begin the process of bringing charges to hold Israeli military and political officials accountable for potential war crimes. That's something that has the Israelis and the U.S., we should add, very, very worried. Now, there's no guarantee it would happen that way. All the political realities mitigate against it. But it changes the political dynamic. So those are the two important advantages. One is this question of moving the diplomacy out of Washington and into the U.N. Second is the possibility to join treaty bodies like the International Criminal Court. But there are dangers, and there's a reason that a number of Palestinians, some inside the occupied territories, but an even greater number in the diaspora among exiles, are very much afraid of this process and very much opposed to this initiative, because they are afraid that the transition from being represented at the UN by the PLO, the liberation organization, that represents all Palestinians, those living under occupation in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, those living in the refugee camps, those living all around the world as exiles who are unable to return home, that they would no longer be represented, that this, quote, state would represent only those living in the occupied territories, which is less than half of the Palestinian population around the world. The other fear is that the right of return, the right of refugees to return to their homes and be compensated, the right guaranteed in UN Resolution 194, would be abandoned. That's the fear. Now, there's nothing legally requiring this new state, if it came into being, even as a member of the UN, to give up representing Palestinian rights around the world and give up their advocacy for the right of return. The reality is they haven't made any headway on the right of return anyway. But that's the basis for the fear among many, many Palestinians, that they will lose their representation and they will lose the advocacy on the right of return. So there's trade-offs here. This is not an easy call for the Palestinians.
Phyllis Bennis, I know some people hope this might shift the ground enough that there could be a new basis for negotiations. What do you think about that?
No, I don't think this is going to change. The U.S. has made clear that it is not prepared to challenge Israeli settlement, to challenge its military aid to Israel, to challenge the siege of Gaza, to challenge the Israeli rejection of the right of return. The Palestinian move is based on international law and human rights. Exactly the opposite of what the U.S.-led so-called peace process is based on, which is Israeli power. Until that changes, there's no hope for these so-called peace talks. It's simply not going to work.
That was Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Find more information on the Palestinian bid for statehood on the Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
On the 15th of September, Palestinians in the D.C. area marched from the State Department to the White House in support of the upcoming vote in the United Nations to recognize Palestine as a state. Here's what one of the marchers had to say about his family's experience in dealing with the Israeli occupation authorities.
I'm Palestinian. My family is originally from Gaza. I am from Jerusalem. I was born and raised in Palestine. I was in Israeli prison with trumped up charges. I'm a member of the Washington Interfaith Alliance for Middle East Peace, where a group of Muslims, Christians, and Jews working together for peace and justice in Palestine. And I know many of us are here today. This is really about theft. It's about theft. Theft of my land. My family lost all their land twice. Everything that they had. All their belongings. Once in 48 we were expelled from West Jerusalem. Another time in 1967. It's really about plain American and decent values anywhere in the world. It's about the people in Gaza who are not allowed to have spaghetti because it's a security infraction according to the Israeli lies. Very soon, the Palestinians will submit
a request to be a full member of the international community, which is a long, long awaited thing. To reclaim a small part, 22% of historical Palestine. We all should support them.
About time the United Nations recognized a Palestinian state in the 1967 borders. Israel had no right to plant settlers outside their own country after the 1967 war. How would you like it if settlers took your house? How would you like it if they kicked you out on the street and stole your country? Anyway, the reason for the September 15th march on the White House in D.C. and on the United Nations in New York City was to warn the United States not to veto or otherwise interfere with the Palestinian statehood resolution in the United Nations. Afghanistan today. NATO is reporting the deaths of two soldiers of unspecified nationality from an insurgent attack in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan ongoing. There has been a sharp rise in the number of amputations suffered by U.S. troops in battle. Amputations have increased from 86 in 2009 to 187 in 2010 and 147 so far this year. All but a dozen of those were in Afghanistan, and the rest were in Iraq. Afghanistan, yesterday. A suicide bomber posing as a Taliban peace envoy assassinated Burhanuddin Rabbani, a former Afghan president who, for the past year, headed a government council trying to negotiate a peace settlement with the insurgents. NATO said in a statement that two suicide bombers were involved in the attack on Rabbani, both of them men who had feigned a desire to reconcile with the government. It was unclear if a second bomber was able to detonate his explosives. Afghan officials, however, insisted there was only one attacker. Ramadi, Iraq, yesterday. Insurgent fighters dressed in the uniforms of the Iraqi government army launched a coordinated, multi-pronged attack on a major government compound. Two police officers, one civilian, and a leader of the so-called Sons of Iraq, a Sunni counterinsurgency coalition regarded by many as traitors, were killed by twin suicide bombers, said Brigadier Mohammad Rashid, the police commander in Ramadi, capital of Anbar province. The first bomb was detonated at the eastern gate of the compound, the second at the western gate, opening two avenues of attack. 15 policemen were injured in the ensuing firefight with five gunmen who breached the perimeter of the compound after the explosions. Police eventually managed to shoot and kill the gunman. They also fatally shot a third would-be suicide bomber before he could trigger his device. The attack is considered only partially successful due to this response from the police. Baghdad, Iraq, today. Mustafa Ghalib, a police colonel, was killed when a magnetic or sticky bomb attached to his car went off in the western district of Amiria, according to an Interior Ministry source reporting to China's Xinhua News Agency. Diyala Province, Iraq, today. Five Iraqi government soldiers were killed when a roadside bomb struck an Iraqi army patrol near a joint U.S. and Iraqi military base some 80 kilometers north of the provincial capital city of Bakuba, according to a source from Diyala's Operations Command, again reporting to China's Xinhua News Agency. Balad, Iraq, today. Three civilians were wounded in a bomb blast directed against Iranian pilgrims in Balad City, south of Salah ad-Din province, security sources reported here today. The two bombs were planted in a garbage box near a restaurant on the international route between Baghdad and Samarra. Obviously, the U.S. occupation has done nothing to stop sectarian violence. Mr. Barack Obama, don't wait until the end of the year to get out of Iraq. You can't change anything there in 90 days. As for Afghanistan, nobody has ever been able to conquer that country. Now's the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home today.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTradio@hushmail.com. Saturday, 17th of September,
Thousands of protesters swarmed into Wall Street with the intention of occupying it indefinitely.
We want to shut down Wall Street!
Although a march on the New York Stock Exchange was blocked by police barricades and cops protecting the immediate area, protesters swarmed the surrounding area. A police closure of the streets surrounding the stock exchange would be very disruptive if it continues into the work week. With Wall Street getting ever richer and everyone else getting ever poorer, people have had enough.
Banks got bailed out, we got sold out. Banks got bailed out, we got sold out.
I'm just corrupt. How a corporation can have a larger voice in the American public is totally beyond me. And I think as far as solutions, we're here to discuss solutions and to come up with ways to move forward in this.
I'm pretty frustrated. I thought we voted for change in 2008. Obviously, we didn't get that.
The police barricades couldn't be everywhere. At number 55 Wall Street, protesters were able to confront a party full of the rich and powerful. Plastic horns are loud and their sounds can carry for blocks like it did during the IMF and World Bank protests last spring. Earlier, at about 10 a.m. on Saturday, as things were starting up, police surrounded a park full of demonstrators as if to try a mass arrest, but they left when protesters stayed.
No, usually I've been one who's kind of been disheartened by protests, that usually they end up being small, random groups of people and broken chants and people who listen when the fucking cops and army scares them away. And so this is really inspiring. I hope I see everybody, this many people, back tomorrow and all week long, and that it continues to grow, because that's amazing.
Protests have continued since then. Marches on Sunday led to few problems. On Monday, there were scattered arrests. On Tuesday, there was considerable police violence, leaving one protester with a gashed leg, another protester with a knocked out tooth, and a third protester with asthma in critical condition after being sat on by a cop trying to choke him out. But protesters have not been deterred. The marches continue, and it is very difficult for all those rich stock traders to get through the traffic as the police on the street try to confine marchers to the sidewalk. Early morning on the 20th of September, at least five protesters were arrested near Wall Street in a brutal police attack on the Occupy Wall Street protests that have been going on since September 17th. The protesters released this statement, quote, "The first arrest was a protester who objected to the police removing a tarp that was protecting our media equipment from the rain. The police said that the tarp constitutes a tent in spite of it not being a habitat in any way. Police continued pressuring protesters with extra legal tactics, saying that a protester on a bullhorn was breaking the law. The protester refused to cease exercising his First Amendment rights and was also arrested." Then the police began to indiscriminately attempt to arrest protesters. Many of them unsheathed their batons, in spite of the fact that the protests remained peaceful. One of the protesters received a large gash on their leg, another lost a tooth. Multiple police tackled the protester and sat on him as he continually warned him that he was experiencing an asthma attack. One of the medics on site informed the police that they needed to call an ambulance because this was a potentially fatal circumstance. They ignored him. "We have no current information on this protester, but we hope he hasn't been murdered by the police." Here's sound from a video recorded as the police attack.
"He can't breathe!
He can't breathe!
I can't breathe!
He can't breathe!
He can't breathe!
Get off him! Get off him! He can't breathe! Look at this! What's this? Are you gonna kill a civilian? You can cuff me!
Give me a
happy breathe! Eric Gershbacher!
Eric Gershbacher!
Step back.
I can tell you from personal experience that some cops really like to try and prevent people from breathing. Fortunately, when a DC pig tried to sit on me for that purpose, I didn't have asthma to deal with, so I lived to tell about it after holding him off with all my strength. This brutality has not deterred the ongoing protest or occupation of the Wall Street area. Violence and brutality will no more work for the NYPD than it worked for Mubarak in Egypt when Tahrir or Liberation Square was seized by protesters, which ultimately led to Mubarak's overthrow. Hopefully the occupation of Wall Street will end in the overthrow of corporate and Wall Street control over American politics. Hey, Congress and state legislators, you need to tax corporate and bankster parasites, not listen to the lobbyists and try to kill their opponents in the street. On Wednesday, the 21st of September, Occupy Wall Street protesters marched around Wall Street for the fifth day in a row, undeterred by the previous day's police violence. The live feed from the opening bell march showed strangely little traffic for Lower Manhattan at 9 a.m., even in areas cars were able to enter, so it looks like people not involved in a protest were avoiding the area, no doubt including many who would otherwise have business with the stock traders. In one video, the 9 a.m. opening bell march, the only thing in the streets is cops on scooters, except for massive hordes of protesters normally forced to the sidewalk by the cops, cross the intersections. This means either car traffic has been prevented from entering the area by the police, a major obstruction to business as usual on a workday in Lower Manhattan, or that people are refusing to enter the area on their own, which has the same impact. Even the anti-terrorism police have been involved at this point. Two so far unconfirmed reports of further police aggression against Occupy Wall Street have emerged Wednesday. At 12:30 p.m., there was a report of a New York pig punching a protester in the face. 15 minutes later, at 12:45, there was a report of two more arrests for unknown reasons. None of the harassment has prevented protesters from holding the plaza, now known as Liberty Plaza or Liberty Park, for 5 days straight. Despite the police harassment, every day in Occupy Wall Street has featured marches and events targeting Wall Street's wealthy and powerful throughout each day, day after day. On the 21st of September, the Industrial Workers of the World, which represents some restaurant and retail workers in New York, joined the protest. Now for an update on the 20th of September police brutality. There are still no reports as of noon on the 21st of September on the condition of the person they sat on while he was having an asthma attack on the 20th. They only admitted to providing medical treatment to one person, and the previous day's brutality injured three. On the other hand, there have been no reports so far of a death in custody, so it looks like he survived. Turns out that New York Mayor Bloomberg told The Guardian UK and The New York Times, quote, "You have a lot of kids graduating college, can't find jobs. That's what happened in Cairo. That's what's happening in Madrid. You don't want those kind of riots here." Thus the September 20th show of police brutality, even though protesters have yet to actually riot. Hey, Mayor Bloomberg, that didn't work for Mubarak in Egypt, and it's not working for you either.
By
despite the widespread coverage and alternative media to the police brutality against Occupy Wall Street on the 20th of September, there was more police aggression and more arrests of peaceful protesters on the 21st of September. Here's sound from a video taken at the site. This incident sounds like it started when the cops punched one of the protesters, as reported earlier Wednesday.
Human life! Human life!
Grab that camera, buried in that mix. Is that what the NYPD is all about now, obstructing justice and destroying evidence? Well, Mr. Bloomberg, if Mubarak in Egypt is your role model, you're going to get the same fate as Mubarak. You're history. Goodbye, Mayor Bloomberg. You're out of here. On the 20th of September, I received a robotic survey call from the Consumer Energy Alliance. They started with two questions. Quote, do you believe gas prices are too high? And, quote, do you believe unemployment is too high? Recognizing that this had to be a fake industry push-pull, I answered no to both questions, even though Wall Street has indeed thrown far too many people out of work. I then managed to start recording the rest of this phony so-called survey, microphone to telephone. Turns out the whole survey is about pressuring the Department of State to approve that nasty tar sands oil pipeline that 1,250 people were arrested in front of the White House saying no to. Here's what my microphone got.
U.S. dependence on imports from the Middle East. To build this importing pipeline, TransCanada must receive a permit from the Department of State that will allow it to cross the border from Canada to the U.S. The Department of State is currently soliciting public comments on whether to grant the permit and allow TransCanada to build the pipeline and put thousands of Americans to work. May we have your permission to relay your support for this vital pipeline?
No, you may not. I oppose the pipeline and I wish the project would be blocked.
Please say yes, no,
no.
Repeat, now.
No.
Would you like more information on
no.
oil and gas production and the jobs that it can create?
No.
Are you male?
Yes.
Are you 50 years of age or older?
No.
Thank you for your time and views. This survey was conducted by the Consumer Energy Alliance. Goodbye. 7 months.
I should have gotten the recording more quickly. It looks to me like the Consumer Energy Alliance is desperate to keep alive our bad romance with fossil fuels and dirty oil. No, I wasn't going to let them falsely tell the Department of State that I support the filthy Alberta tar sands mining. I'd rather see gasoline cost 10 bucks a gallon than support a pipeline whose contributions to global warming is going to flood every coastal city, including mine. On the 13th of September, as Congress was coming back into session, activists from the Transportation Equity Network and from a faith group stormed the Republican Party's South Capitol Street headquarters. Officially, the purpose of the protest was to demand that Speaker Cantor support Obama's jobs bill. But unofficially, there were far more demands, such as raising taxes on the wealthy to a level that would balance the budget, and a federal transit initiative to rival the interstate highway program that former President Eisenhower set up.
I'm going to give her story about how transit is so important to her life.
Linda, I'm
going to have a big
New York voice, go through.
I'm a transit rider.
I had to quit my job because I needed transit to get to places and to work, and I couldn't do it. I cannot visit my grandkids because there is no regional transit to get to where they are, even though they live close to me. Doctor appointments are impossible in the suburbs. It takes a long time. It's a difficult situation when bus companies cut routes, cut times buses run, cut services all around, Saturday, Sunday, weekend. It's just a very difficult thing. And please do not cut Medicare, Medicaid, so we elderly and disabled won't be able to use transportation if we don't have the money when in our retirement or in our times of need. So that's my message.
Yeah! The entire protest got to the GOP's headquarters on South Capitol Street by riding the Metro, and a ride of less than a mile from I Street took far longer than it should have. One of the protesters was in a wheelchair. It was not easy for him to get around and maneuver through Metro's notorious elevators.
We were coming here from I Street, down at the Capitol Street Hotel. We had to take the subway. We had to work around getting elevators to the end of one section to the bus to get to around, to go up, we went down, to go over. It probably took us four times as long as it should have. The sidewalks are horrendous because wheelchairs are not, they make these cute little wheels on the front that get stuck in all kinds of little divots. Accessibility for the handicapped is hard, and we just want to use the transportation in a way to get where we need to go.
Now we all know how much money it's costing just to fix Metro. You can imagine how much money it's going to cost to fix transit everywhere. While Obama's jobs bill really didn't do a lot to talk about how to pay for everything, talked about kicking things down the road to the super committee to make decisions about other budget cuts, the protesters who stormed the Republican Party's headquarters on the 13th of September had a better idea.
Balance the budget, tax the wealthy, that's how we make America healthy. Balance the budget, tax the wealthy, that's how we make America healthy.
I don't suppose the Tea Party is going to like this suggestion from the protest either.
Less cars and more buses and trains.
Yeah.
This is what democracy looks like.
You heard that. Politics in the United States has now reached the point that transit advocates who have the support of one of the political parties, the Democrats, find it necessary to storm the headquarters of the other political party, the Republicans, in order to have any chance of being heard.
During his September 8th speech before a joint session of Congress promoting the White House jobs program, President Obama called for billions of dollars in spending on infrastructure projects and other government programs to stimulate the creation of jobs in an economy plagued by a 9.1% unemployment rate. During the address, Mr. Obama also called for congressional passage of three controversial free trade pacts, stating it's time to clear the way for a series of trade agreements that would make it easier for American companies to sell their products in Panama, Colombia, and South Korea. The proposed free trade agreements with Panama, Colombia, and South Korea, negotiated under President Bush, have fairly broad support from Republicans. But some newly elected GOP Tea Party legislators who campaigned against free trade may end up siding with many Democrats who have long opposed free trade legislation. Senator Sherrod Brown, Democrat of Ohio, although a strong supporter of President Obama, has condemned the proposed trade treaties. He said in December, "I continue to believe it is a dangerous mistake to pursue the same kind of trade deals that ballooned our deficit and led to massive job loss. I see no reason to pursue more NAFTA-style free trade agreements." AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka has warned that a free trade agreement with South Korea will cost U.S. workers 159,000 jobs, while a deal with Colombia will cost 54,000 jobs. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Arthur Stamoulis, executive director of the Citizens Trade Campaign, a national coalition of environmental, labor, and other civil society groups founded in 1992 to improve the North American Free Trade Agreement. He explains why his coalition is opposed to passage of these three free trade pacts and concerns about negotiations on a new trans-Pacific free trade agreement.
Free trade agreements are by no means job creation plans. You know, we should have recognized that after the past 15 years plus under NAFTA, under the WTO. And the trade agreements with Korea, with Colombia, with Panama, it's the biggest package of free trade agreements in a decade. The Korea Free Trade Agreement is, in fact, the largest free trade agreement since NAFTA. And these are trade agreements that even the federal government's own International Trade Commission predicts are going to increase the overall U.S. trade deficit. The ITC, the International Trade Commission, doesn't attach job numbers to that, but it makes sense. If you're selling less than what you're buying, if you're importing more than you're exporting, these are going to be net job killers. And just like, you know, every dollar of exports means a potential job in the U.S., every dollar of imports means a potential job loss. And unfortunately, especially with a trade deal like Korea, we're going to be importing more cars, we're going to be importing more high-tech products, we're going to be importing more green tech products. The high-paying manufacturing jobs and the high-tech jobs that are supposed to represent the jobs of the future are going to be lost under these trade deals.
Now, these were negotiated under the George W. Bush administration, and labor has long said unless there is protection for U.S. jobs, as well as major protections for workers in these countries and environmental concerns addressed, that these agreements really harken back to the same problems we saw unfold with NAFTA. What's the Obama administration stand on really strengthening the position of labor in these agreements and environmental standards that seem to be lacking in these countries, which really lures big companies in this country to move overseas where they don't have to be regulated as much?
You're right. I mean, these are trade deals that George W. Bush negotiated over 3 years ago that he was never able to get through Congress, that President Obama himself campaigned against when he was running for office, and unfortunately has now sort of picked up and dusted off and championed it as his own. The Korea Free Trade Agreement is a trade deal that the Economic Policy Institute predicts, if enacted, Korean imports will cost 888,000 American jobs within just 7 years. Now, obviously, we'll create some jobs due to new exports, too, but nowhere near that many. And again, these are good-paying, high union density manufacturing jobs, high-tech jobs being lost to South Korea, where, you know, it's not a country as bad as Colombia, which is the deadliest country in the world to be a trade union member and has horrendous human rights violations and labor rights violations. But, you know, it's a country where workers are paid a lot less. And there's actually a provision in the Korea Free Trade Agreement called Rule of Origin that would allow up to 65% of the value of a good assembled in South Korea to come from third-party countries like China, like Vietnam, even North Korea, under this trade agreement and to enter the United States duty-free. And that's one reason why, in addition to U.S. unions opposing this, South Korean unions oppose it too, because they recognize this as furthering the race to the bottom and allowing more and more production to move to countries with less and less rights for workers, for the environment, for consumer protection.
There have been talks recently on something called the Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement involving many nations in the Pacific Basin. And I wonder if you would explain to our listeners where these talks are headed, what's at stake, and your view on the Obama administration's handling of this new trade agreement being negotiated.
Yeah, so the Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement is a new Pacific Rim trade deal under negotiation between the United States and nine other countries in North, South America, Asia, the Pacific Rim. This is the Obama administration's first deal that they're negotiating from scratch. So, you know, there's no excuse. This is the trade agreement that the Obama administration wants. And right now, you know, most of the negotiating documents are secret. What has been leaked suggests that this is very much, unfortunately, a business-as-usual trade deal. And so we've been out there, you know, letting the administration know, trade negotiators know, that we expect a fair deal or no deal, that, you know, we're not going to put up with another NAFTA. One of the big reasons that corporations are pushing for this deal is because they feel Chinese workers are being paid too much. You know, first our jobs went from the U.S. to Mexico, then from Mexico to China. And now the manufacturers are saying, well, you know, the Chinese are demanding too much and being paid too much. We need to move these jobs to countries like Vietnam and Malaysia. That is a race to the bottom that no working person in any country is ever going to win. That's something we need to reverse. And if we're going to have a free trade agreement for the Pacific Rim, it has to have clear, strong, enforceable labor standards. It needs to have better standards on the environment and consumer protection. There needs to be a clear mandate protecting access to generic medications for sick people. And there needs to be better respect for family farmers. And if we don't get that, we're going to be fighting this trade deal just as hard.
That was Arthur Stamoulis, executive director of the Citizens Trade Campaign. Learn more about opposition to U.S. free trade pacts by visiting our website at btlonline.org.
On Friday, the 16th of September, people all over the United States staged protests against the execution of Troy Davis, which will take place this week unless either the governor or the Supreme Court intervenes.
Hey, Georgia!
Seven out of nine witnesses have recanted their testimony. Here's what a speaker had to say about the case and the politics surrounding the case at the march in D.C. on the 16th of September.
Nine people testified that they saw Troy Davis kill Officer McPhail. Seven have since recanted and said that was not the case. Seven! That means they're going to kill someone on that kind of basis? When you can't even put Dominique Strauss-Kahn on trial in New York?
Oh!
Are you kidding me? We know the truth. Troy Davis is on death row in Georgia because he was in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong color skin with the wrong bank account. He doesn't have that going up against him. He's not on death row. And for that reason alone, he should not be there, and we have to fight to make that happen. Look at the people coming out for Troy. Desmond Tutu, Jimmy Carter, John Lewis. Here's a name for you. William Sessions. If you don't know who that is, he was the head of the FBI in the Reagan administration. That means he makes Rick Perry look like Karl Marx. And even he has stepped forward and said this execution cannot happen. So we've got the wind at our back right now, and we have to do it. Poverty's at a 20-year high, and we know following economic hard times comes racism, criminal justice, and the death penalty to divide us against each other. If they can get away with killing Troy, then what hope do we have? What hope do we have against what's coming? We have to stand up for Troy right now because our lives depend on it. You got Republicans cheering the number of executions in Rick Perry's Texas. You've got Democrats as quiet as church mice. If we're going to build this movement, it's got to come from us. We're the ones who are going to have to make this happen. And I just want to end with one thing. I got phone calls today when this rally got out from two people you might have heard of. Their names are Tommy Smith and John Carlos. They were the people who raised their fist at the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City. Tommy Smith from Georgia, John Carlos about to move to Georgia. This is very close to them. They both wanted to express their solidarity, and John, who really does like to talk, gave me a couple of sentences he wanted me to read to you all today, and I'll end with that right now. This is what John Carlos said. He said, "I've lived a lot of years, and I've seen many things, but I didn't think I'd live long enough to see a lynching return to the state of Georgia. This has to end. Troy Davis must be free, and I'll raise my fist as many times as necessary to make it happen." Thank you very much. Free Troy Davis.
A state of Georgia, there's one other thing you might want to think about. You execute an African-American man, in this kind of situation, there might be consequences. You don't have a monopoly on rope. Before you tie a noose for Troy Davis, you might want to think about who might be tying one for you. Update, update. Those white racists in Georgia are ignoring the entire country. Troy Davis is still scheduled to be executed at 7 p.m. tonight. Only two people are currently listed as being able to stop it. The President of the United States, Mr. Barack Obama, himself an African American, he ought to step into this. And the jerk down in Georgia who originally issued the death warrant in the first place. If Troy Davis dies, look out.
Cambodia's president, Hun Sen, facing a cutoff of World Bank development loans, has agreed to set aside land in the capital city of Phnom Penh for people evicted to make way for a Chinese-financed luxury development. In mid-August, under growing pressure from housing activists opposed to the massive Bong Kok Lake project to build high-end housing and shops, the World Bank voted to cut loans for new development projects. However, the World Bank will continue to fund $350 million in existing health and education projects in Cambodia, one of Asia's poorest countries. Reuters reports over 15,000 city residents have already been evicted from their homes to make way for the Chinese-financed housing and shopping development. Land seizures that result in homelessness are among Cambodia's most pressing human rights issues. Property deeds and other land records were mostly destroyed under the Khmer Rouge's genocidal regime in the late 1970s. According to the Guardian newspaper, housing groups in Cambodia say residents in the development zone are denied due process in eviction claims or asserting property rights in violation of World Bank policy. Each year in Cambodia, an estimated 30,000 people are forced to move off their land to make room for real estate development, mining, and agricultural projects.